Welcome to the Anderson Business Advisors Podcast, the nationally recognized preferred provider for asset protection and tax planning in the nation. This show is for investors and business owners looking to save on taxes and build long-term wealth with Toby Mathis, an attorney, author, business owner, and a featured instructor at Anderson's Tax and Asset Protection event held throughout the country. Enjoy the show.
Hey guys, this is Toby Mathis
and Jeff Webb,
and you're listening to Tax Tuesday, where we bring lots of fun tax knowledge to the masses. So first off, happy summer. I guess we're right in the thick of it, about 100 degrees here in Vegas. Hopefully you're getting some sunshine. Just to be completely annoying, Alexa, play Tax Tuesday. Let's see. I wonder how many of you guys actually had your stuff going. I didn't realize that you could like control somebody's Alexa from another machine.
Oh, yeah.
So if you had that on speaker, you really hate me right now. Maybe it actually switched you off. All right. So let's get jumping on in. It is just a little after 3 hour time. So we're ready to get rolling. I already have some questions coming in, which we will get to. There's some really good ones already. Love of questions. And then, of course, you can ask questions via the chat feature. So let's get jumping on in. Send in your questions at Tax Tuesday, or just at taxtuesday@andersonadvisors.com. You see the link there. And that's where I grab the questions we go over. Depending on how quickly our staff gets through them, I usually grab a whole bunch of them. If we have time today, I'm going to dive into all those as well. If you need a detailed response, like if it's very specific to you, you're going to need to become a client. And that comes in the form of two ways. You can either become a Platinum member or a tax client. Both very easy to do. You can always contact Tax Tuesday at Anderson Advisors and say, hey, I need to get some of my personal questions answered, and they'll get you where you need to go. This is fast, fun, and educational. We want to give back and help educate. As you guys know, that we don't get paid to do this. We have a lot of CPAs that jump onto these calls. I just like the idea that business owners not overpaying. For me, that just, for whatever reason, I get a little bit of joy out of that. Maybe I'm weird. Hey, if you like this sort of stuff, go to our Facebook and YouTube channels. You can always find it at Anderson Advisors/Facebook/YouTube. All those fun things. I think you can even go to /podcast. All those will get you to where you can actually keep feeding your mind. Oh, here's a whole bunch of fun stuff. More questions coming in. So I think we're going to have our hands full today. Speaking of which, let's talk about the questions we have. These are the questions we're going to go over today. Should a California buyer purchase investment rental property in Tennessee in an LLC or hold individually with umbrella insurance? We'll answer that. What is the best way to transfer title and real estate without increasing the property taxes after joint tenant dies? My S-Corp will make only around $20,000 this year. Do I still need to pay myself a salary? I'll answer that one. When can I legally take money from a 403B and transfer to a QRP? And how much or what percentage can I transfer if I'm still employed? I inserted the extra words there. But what percentage if I'm still employed? What is different about filing taxes for option traders as opposed to stock traders? Can an individual place Bitcoin in a Roth IRA account? More, I will be shutting down an LLC, which has lots of expenses tied to it. Can these be rolled over to the C Corp or a new LLC? Can I pay my life insurance or family dental insurance from my LLC? Can the LLC fund my HSA? We'll answer that as well. HSAs are interesting. I just learned a property I bought and rehabbed is in an opportunity zone. Can I retroactively qualify for tax advantages, for the wonderful tax advantages from an opportunity zone? Is there still a mileage deduction if I drive my personal vehicle for my business or to get a job out of state? Next one. I have two sub-S corps. I believe that you were talking about Q-subs here that I've placed all my real estate under. Should I place the properties in LLCs? Any tax concerns? How do we navigate the standard deduction in the business sector? So let's just jump right on in and see what we can get. We'll see what kind of interesting questions we answer today and how many additional questions come out of it. All right. Should a California buyer purchase investment rental property in Tennessee in an LLC, or should they just hold it individually with umbrella insurance?
Yeah, I kind of got mixed feelings on this. I got to think that the LLC is going to be the cheaper liability protection for your rental property. I would think for the ultimate protection, you put it in an LLC, but you still have an umbrella policy.
Yeah, you always do both. So I'll make it real easy. I've actually watched people lose virtually everything they own. End up in bankruptcy is what ends up happening. Because they follow the advice of doing the insurance. Now, How often does that happen? It's a very, very low percentage.
Right.
The question is, why risk it? In other words, you're going into this, why would you put yourself in a scenario where you could lose everything? So if I'm in California especially, I want to make sure that any rental property that I hold does not get drawn back into California if possible. Because California, well, you have very plaintiff-friendly laws. I want to keep out of the state of California, and there are ways to do that. If I have property in Tennessee, I'm just going to say that the rule of thumb is the LLC holding the real estate, and there's inside and outside liability real estate. In fact, I should just draw that up. Give me just a second here. I'm going to make myself a pen so you can actually see it. Let's see. There it is. So let's just say that we have a piece of property. There's inside liability, so pretend that's a piece of real estate. There's inside liability, so if something bad happens on that real estate, you want it to stay inside that box. But I'm standing out here, pretend that's me. Hi, guys. And I do something. Let's say I'm driving down the road in my sports car and I hit somebody. And so they're out, right? That person, let's say that I squished them, but let's just say that I hit somebody and they sued me. They're looking at outside liability. They're going to come after my LLC. And so for real estate, we always want to have the inside liability trapped in a local LLC. So that would be a Tennessee LLC if that's where the real estate is. Now, there are some fancy ways to get around this sometimes. I'm just going to say that as a general rule, you're going to put it in there unless there's a reason not to. But my outside liability, I may stick another LLC and hold it in Wyoming that's going to own that piece of real estate. So if anybody ever comes after me, they're going to be stuck with the state of Wyoming. The reason we do that is because you have charging order only protections. So you get into this. Somebody says, in that situation, living in California, property in another state, how do you avoid getting double taxed? Well, because Tennessee taxes you, in this particular case, we'd be looking at having you own it individually and then assigning your interest over to the Wyoming because they have something called a family-owned non-corporate entity exclusion that does not tax you. The income will always flow onto your personal return here and end up on your California tax return and personal. So what you're always going to end up doing, the taxes are going to flow down to you no matter what. So in this particular case, if we're using Tennessee, we don't want to be subject to Tennessee taxation. So we're going to make sure that we qualify under FONS, which is, again, family-owned non-corporate entity. An LLC qualifies if you own it. We'll assign that to a Wyoming entity so that nobody could ever take your stuff away. And what we're going to end up getting to is a situation where you have lots of asset protection. The tax all flows down onto your personal 1040, and we literally will have zero tax returns if we don't want to. Somebody says, can you replace Wyoming with Texas? Texas is good, but the best is Nevada in Wyoming. Those are the two best as far as having very clear-cut statutes that say the sole and exclusive remedy, even in the case of single-owner LLCs, is a charging order. So what you want to make sure of is that you get away from paying. I shouldn't say paying. You want to get away from the court having any ability to get around the LLC, and you want to stick it in a place that's not in your backyard. So it tends to make state judges go a little nutty when they don't have jurisdiction over an entity. You end up having to go to Wyoming in this case and assert your interest against there, and all they get is a lien. And there are lots of questions coming in on this. Do you still pay the LLC fee? It's actually $800 a year. They said $700. It's $800 a year. Yeah, you're still going to pay the $800, but it's typically going to be on what you own. So I would have it under that Wyoming. If you ask California, we just had a Supreme Court decision that is horrendous for anybody who deals with California. And that was the Hyatt v. Commissioner decision that our Supreme Court just reconsidered for the third time, where they said that the California Franchise Tax Board was not liable for tortious conduct towards its citizens, even if they go out of state. You know, I'm not going to get into all of it, but it was a pretty bad fact scenario where they followed somebody into Nevada and broke into their house, dug through their garbage, and they just got found where they're not responsible. They can't be held liable. So they're going to be very aggressive. So if you ask them, they're always going to say, pay us the tax. What I do is I say, hey, I have one entity that pays the tax, and leave it at that. All right, so I'm not going to keep jumping into. How does that flow on the tax return, Luis? I think it is, Luis. It flows onto your 1040 on your Schedule E, which is where your real estate holds. And the way it flows through is this Tennessee entity is always going to be ignored for tax purposes. So I'm just going to pretend that it's not even there. It's not going to file Tennessee taxes. It's It's only you're going to file the taxes on this. Now, you may still have to file a Tennessee tax return for that rental income. Even it would be no different than if it was just you owning it. And then that Wyoming entity is either going to be a partnership, which files a 1065, or it's going to be disregarded, meaning it doesn't file anything. If it files a 1065, it flows onto page 2 of your Schedule E. If it's disregarded, it just goes to page 1 of your Schedule E. Jeff, if I said anything, that's wacky.
No, I agree. And the nice thing about Tennessee is, like Nevada, Texas, and Wyoming, they don't have an individual income tax.
Right.
Unless you earn interest and dividends. I believe they tax those.
There's some.
So, again, you may have to file a form with Tennessee, but otherwise it's going to look like it's not going to matter whether it's an LLC or not for tax purposes.
Mm-hmm. Now, here's somebody says, what about Oklahoma? Yeah, you could do Oklahoma. So look, you could just change the name. I have property in Oklahoma, and this is exactly what I do. I have Oklahoma City, I have several, few dozen properties there. And we do the exact same thing. We have an Oklahoma LLC pointed to a holding company that falls onto our return, and it files a partnership return. So it's pretty standard. This is what you do. Somebody said, what about the anonymity? Can't they still see me? In Tennessee, if you want to get away from ownership being traceable back to you, you use a land trust. And I don't want to get too far off track. You use a land trust to hold the real estate. That way it's not even in the LLC name, so they don't see your name. So that's how it gets kind of fun. On October, let's see, somebody says use an EIN from owner, not disregarding even hell is anything to be aware of in completing this form. No, yeah, and on W-9, that's federal tax. They're just looking to, again, they're tying it in. So the question was, hey, on a W-9, it's asking for the owner's social security number because that's where it's going to be reported.
Right.
Even if an LLC has its own tax number, we're telling the IRS to ignore it. Now, if it's a partnership, different story. It's filing its own return. It's giving you a K-1.
But real quick on that W-9, you're going to list on line 1, you're required to list the ultimate owner's name. And line 2, you would list the LLC's name. So
now somebody always pops in. All right, so going back to Tennessee, somebody says, hey, there's an excise tax in Tennessee. Correct. That's why we filed the FONTS, which is how we avoid it. It's a family-owned, non-corporate entity exclusion. And so that's why we're filing the FONTS. And then the LLC is always going to need a registered agent. If you live there, you got to act as your own. If you need one, then it's us. You're always going to do that. And yes, there's a cost to it. It's cheap insurance. Trust me. And you always have to be careful when a lawyer says, trust me. But you always look at it and say, it's much better to have something and go, man, that was $125 that I just threw away and never need it, than to lose everything saying, man, I wish I had paid that $125. Right. That would have been way cheaper. And what we're really talking about is avoiding the lawsuit altogether. We don't want someone to see everything you own. Now, this is a tax webinar. So I'm just going to say from a tax standpoint, we set these things up to be ignored. From an asset protection standpoint, you set things up to where people can't see it. The whole idea is if they can't see that you own stuff, the likelihood of you being sued goes down considerably. In fact, it'll go down to zero. And so what we see with our clients, and we have tens of thousands of clients that own substantial assets, they just don't get sued very often. It's very, very seldom. Now, I can tell you when we see problems, it's almost always somebody walking in who went off of just insurance and the insurance gets declined, or they're dealing with insurance with a reservation of rights and they're freaking out because somebody saw what they owned. We had a father-son team where we saw this thing play itself out, and it was a multi-million dollar claim where they were looking for a responsible party. The son got out for nothing, literally, because they couldn't see what he owned. Dad had everything in his name, and they pegged him to the wall. They just would not let go of him. And you have something called joint and several liability in many cases where if you're 1% at fault, you're 100% liable. And so they're just looking for the party that they can name that has the money. And if you like having all your stuff in your name, you know, then you'll get that joy of getting those lawsuits. If you don't have it in your name and you have it in, you have it separated out where they can't trace it, then you don't get it. Yeah, somebody says, what's FONTS? Family-owned, non-corporate entity exception. It's in Tennessee, and it keeps you from paying the excise tax. Let's see. Somebody says, platinum member, what is my cost to be a registered agent in Texas? I think it's $125 a year. You said each rental property gets its own LLC. Does each land trust only hold one property? And could I put all my rentals in one land trust? You'd use separate land trusts. Mm-hmm. And Michelle, you may use one or more like you may put two or three properties in an LLC. Best practice is to have one LLC, but we know there's costs involved and every state's different. So if you're in Ohio, it's really cheap. If you're in Texas, it's more expensive. So you're always looking at it saying, hey, what is it worth to separate it out? And it really depends on what type of property it is. Is it $1 million property with $500,000 of equity? Or is it a $50,000 house? You know, so you can go in and say, hey, I really don't want to spend a ton of money on my LLCs because they're really expensive. Maybe I'll use land trust. And that's way better than, you know, I don't want to throw a bunch of money away. Unlike little houses, $25,000 houses, if you're in Tennessee, for example, or in Kansas City or some of these others, you may not want to spend $1,000 setting up an entity. You may say, hey, you know what? I'll just go with the land trust and I'll put five or six properties. It's whatever you're willing to lose. So again, I can tell you best practice is separate LLCs, but I know that's not always. When would you use a land trust versus a DST, Delaware Statutory Trust, to own a property? So a land trust is a grantor trust ignored for tax purposes. So is a Delaware Statutory Trust, but Delaware Statutory Trusts are used when you're doing a 1031 exchange, generally speaking. Otherwise, your land trust is going to be sufficient when you, depending on what state you're in. In other words, the land trust should be a local entity. If you're using a Delaware statutory trust, more likely than not, you have to have a land trust pointing to it anyway. My properties are managed by property managers. When the property manager told someone that I'm the owner, someone can still find out. It's not about keeping. So Carolyn, let's say that you're my tenant and you find out that this Toby Mathis guy owns your house. And then you say, hey, I'm thinking about suing him. And then they run Toby Mathis and they go see what else did he own. And they can't find anything else. That's what you want. You don't want it to where, hey, nobody could ever know that I own a piece of property. What you want to make it is that unless you tell them or unless they really do some serious, like they must know somebody and they really had to dig around for it, they're not going to find it. You know, and I would say, good luck. You know who I am. Go find everything I own. It would be really difficult. And all you're trying to do is put up hurdles so people don't just tag you. I've had clients that have been sued simply because they could see that they own a personal property in California and Huntington Beach. And they say, you must have money. It's so there's always going to be a threshold where you say, hey, someone's just bad taste. What you don't want to do is tempt it by saying, hey, I found your property. And by the way, I could see you own 10 more in town. That's a much different lawsuit. Hey, I have something I can get and the local judge can order it. All right. Bunch of questions. That land trust, does it trigger the due on sale clause? Not necessarily. So Fabiola, this is under the Garn-St-Germain Act. So Garn-St-Germain says that if you have a piece of property that you put into trust and it's your personal residence, they cannot call the note due. But as a practical matter, when you put things into trust, banks don't call them due. We've done tens of thousands of these and never had one called due. You don't get them called due when you put them in an LLC either, for the most part. It's the only time you see them called due is when you tell the bank, hey, I'm going to put it in there. As long as they're getting paid, they generally don't care. Let's see. Yeah, so somebody said, hey, I asked it because I had property in LLC, but when I refinanced, the bank had me quit clean it to my name. Yep, because that's the only way. Whenever you refi, even in a trust, they're going to make you take it out of your name. I mean, take it back and put it in your name if it's a conventional loan.
I've seen that quite a few times.
Yep, and the reason being is because with a land trust or an LLC, I can change the ownership very quickly. So the bank really doesn't know. It kind of gets funny. So
yeah, the only time I've ever seen a note called in those cases is where the bank felt that their investment was truly in danger.
Yep, and if you do a commercial loan, by the way, and you do an LLC, they're not going to want you to close in your name. They're going to want to close in the name of the LLC. And they're almost always, I can just tell you because I've done a bunch of these, they're almost always going to want the loan to be with a special purpose entity, usually in Delaware, and the property to be owned by another LLC. In other words, they just don't want the headache of you or the properties getting into the way of that loan. And then in which case, they're going to do a loan directly to you. And if you ask for lenders, I could tell you A10 is a good one. CoreVest is a good one. There's some really good guys out there. They will not let you close in your name. That's when you're actually buying in an entity. Let's see. Do we have to list every property or a total amount on the 1040 Schedule E? So Larice, if you have a bunch of personal properties that are going on page one, they would be listed. If you do this through a partnership, hint, hint, Then you do a total, and it goes on page 2 of your Schedule E.
But then we have to list them separately on the partnership return.
Yep. You're still going to list them. It's just not on your personal.
Schedule E, correct.
Right. So here's why you don't – this is why you use the partnership. Because if you go in for a loan and you have 50 properties on your page 1, good luck. If you go in for a loan and you have a K-1 that says here's the total amount that you're making, much easier. So right. I'm just going to say and – if you are ever going to sell commercial property, you want to make sure that it's in a partnership because the buyer, if they're financing it, for example, if they're buying an apartment complex, they're going to need that separate tax return to qualify for the loan. And it's really going to be frustrating when you tried to, you know, hey, I saved a little bit of money, but now I can't sell my building. We have a lender's name here for the ones that won't close without an LLC. Can we have the lender's name here for the ones that won't close without? Oh, CoreVest and A10. There's a whole bunch out there, but you look at CoreVest is the one that I use. I've done both. I'm trying to think if I've done some others. I've done some others. Bank in Hawaii. I've bought some properties there. Somebody just asked about, would you do the same thing in Indiana? If you live in Hawaii, absolutely. That's exactly what you do. You'd own the property in an Indiana LLC or land trust pointed to an Indiana LLC and have that owned by a Wyoming LLC, and then you would own it and you're living in Hawaii. Sounds complicated, but once you get used to it, there's only one way to do it, right? So it's kind of like, hey, here's easy. Somebody says we are building a new house. It will be partially financed. At what point do we get it into your living trust? After you cash out that loan. So when you're doing a building loan, usually they're going to cash it out when you're done. What is the best way to transfer title in real estate without increasing property taxes after a joint tenant dies?
I wouldn't think this would trigger an increase in property values.
All right, I'll tell you this. I have never seen it trigger when you move it from the surviving joint tenant to their individual name. Usually what they're doing, and it depends on, it's county by county, state by state. But if you are a joint tenant and you're the survivor, generally speaking, you publish the certified death certificate. And in some cases, you're doing an affidavit saying that you're now the sole owner and you're going to warranty deed it into your own name. You don't really have to do that, though, because just by being a joint tenant with right of survivorship, you are the owner when you pass, when the other joint tenant passes. So you'll need it when you sell it, but a lot of people just let it sit there and just keep paying it, even though it's in both names. You do not have to probate that asset just because it's joint tenants with right of survivorship. So what you do need is the death certificate. So if somebody passes and you're a joint tenant with right of survivorship, just make sure you get that. And in many cases, you just file that with your county and be done. If I put a property in a land trust, would the title name change too since it's a public record? Yes, it'll be yourself as trustee. Or a lot of times what we do is an LLC. We're kind of evil. We don't like people being able to see what we own. So we usually use an LLC as the trustee. It's kind of fun. My S corporation will only make around $20,000 this year. Do I still need to pay myself a salary? This is a tricky one.
You want to give the multiple answer is
no. I like watching Jeff because I know what he wants to do. He wants to say
it depends.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. There you go. I thought you were going to say yes.
No, I'm not going to do that. So you did make a profit, but then it comes down to, did you make any distributions?
There you go. That's the big one. So the answer is, if you made 20K and you left it in the company, no. If you made 20K and you took it out, the answer is yes, you have to pay yourself a reasonable salary. Isn't that fun?
Yeah.
All right. And then how much should you pay yourself as a salary?
I think this question gets a little harder with the smaller profit because you have reasonable versus what you can adequately pay.
See, that's what's fun. The test is, generally speaking, is a reasonable salary. But the question is, what's a reasonable salary? It's facts and circumstances, and they give us no mathematical test. What we know is that there's cases, and every case, it seems like they do about a third.
Yeah, they like to tell us we're wrong, but not necessarily why we're wrong.
Here's the thing. You're not going to go to court over taking a third. I don't think – have you ever seen an audit actually go off the rails when they're doing a third?
No, I haven't really seen that many go off the rails, period, because it's a different audit.
And they're so excited that you're actually paying yourself a salary because 80% don't. Oh, this is funny. Let's see. I switched two rental properties under my name to two LLC 2 months ago. I also got the local title company to do a quitclaim deed to get my ownership to LLC. But I wonder why a city website in Philadelphia, I can still see the name as the owner of those properties. So chances are it's just because it hasn't updated. Sometimes it takes them a while.
Yeah.
The thing about Philadelphia or Pennsylvania as a whole is that's the one state where they'll charge you for the transfer into anything. Even if you put it into into trust, it's pretty annoying. So, and then somebody says, how would the $20,000 flow to your tax return? So Rory, that's going to go on the S Corp files here. I'll write this up so you can follow it. The S Corp files a form 1120S and it issues a K-1 to the owner. That K-1 goes on the owner's 1040 Schedule E page 2. You're going to see we like page 2 of Schedule E. So that's how it flows. So that $20,000 is going to show up as income, just the profit. So if you took no salary, obviously, it's going to just flow down. You're going to get what's called a 199A deduction, which is going to shave off 20% of that, most likely. So if you had $20,000, you're going to get a 20% haircut under the Tax Cut and Jobs Act. So you're going to only have to show $16,000 of income.
I always wait for you to do the math so I can check it.
Yeah. So that's assuming that you're not, you know, above some income threshold.
Attention all real estate investors, business owners, stock traders, and anyone looking to get out of the rat race for good. We all know time is money, but did you know there's a wealth of resources on how to make more money, keep more money, and protect what you've earned all for free online? Anderson Business Advisors YouTube channel offers free resources on asset protection and tax reduction from lawyers and CPAs designed to help you keep more money in your pocket. To learn how to limit your liability, protect what you've earned, and minimize your tax burden all for free, subscribe to Anderson Business Advisors on YouTube today.
Somebody says, is it possible to pay a salary at the end of the year instead of taking a salary every month? So, Lua, absolutely. In fact, there's no federal law that says you have to pay people on a regular basis. There's state laws that do, but you're an exempt employee.
And we see that a lot with closely held businesses, single owners and such, that they'll pay themselves near the end of the tax year.
Yep. Hey, this is an interesting one. Diana, this is going back to our previous question because I just can't let it go. All right. What tax status should we elect, partnership or disregarded, for a Wyoming holding company that owns Wyoming rental LLCs with California properties out in land trust? So I already like that structure. We've actually won an audit on that about 2 years ago. Maybe it's 3 years ago now. Because technically what you want to make sure of is that the holding company is owned by a trust. So you don't want to personally own it. You want to own it through your living trust. And we actually won that audit. It was kind of fun. And I think Jeff is dying over here. Quit dying. I'm not going to give you like mouth to mouth or any of that stuff.
Because I can't use the insurance. Like
that. Don't die on me. All right. We are a husband and wife and live in California and materially participate. So I like the material participation, but if you're going to be a real estate professional, which is the bigger one, you have to do the 750 hours and materially participate. And that's called electing real estate professional status. You actually put it on the notes of your return. You have to you'd want to aggregate all your activities too. And then you'd have an LLC tax and C Corp to manage it. So Diana, you're doing exactly the way that I'd structure it. You'd have your California entity there that's already paying the $800. You're not being a complete pig, and then you're making sure that when you're acting on behalf, you're acting as a trust. So you're going to make sure that you're a living trust, or if you don't have a living trust, you use a personal property trust to own that Wyoming. Under your situation, if I'm not looking at financing, I'm owning it as a disregarded. I'm going to have that as a disregarded entity. In fact, zero tax returns is always best. If you are ever going to have to, how would I say it? If you're going to do financing or if you're going to have to go out and get a loan, then you're going to want to make sure that you're filing that partnership return. But then you're going to have to file the California Franchise Tax Board, the $800 on that LLC. So it's up to you. Where do you put real estate professional on your return?
Real estate professional is an election you make every year. It's not really a form. It's just a statement that gets included with your 1040.
Mm-hmm. So you just track the 750 hours and you're just making a certification that you did it. And technically, it's 750 hours and 50% or more of your personal services, whichever is greater.
And where this calculation actually goes is on Schedule E, page 2 at the bottom of the form.
Yep. So you're going to see that keeps coming up. That page 2 is our magic number. Is it better for a holding company owned by a living trust or DST? I'm going to say two different animals, but I'm going to say a living trust is where you generally want to have everything pointed. Somebody says, hey, if it's owned by a living trust and I'm sued, wouldn't my LLC assets be subject to charging order? It doesn't matter whether you're a living trust or just you. It makes zero difference. So I hope that makes sense. Because living trusts provide zero asset protection. They're just there for estate planning. So when can I illegally take money from my 403B and transfer to a QRP? And how much or what percentage if I'm still employed? You want to hit this one?
Well, when you can take money out of your 403B depends on whether you're still employed. A lot of plans won't let you take money out. Most plans won't let you withdraw money if you're still employed, except in hardship cases. That includes 403B, 401K, 457 plan. So it's going to be determined by the plan itself, the 403B and your employer.
Yep. So what it really comes down to is when can I legally take money out of my 403B immediately at any time you want. There's nothing illegal about taking money out of a 403B. And a 403B is a fancy way of saying a nonprofit's retirement plan. So that's like a 401K for a nonprofit. So I have a 403B or a 401K or 457 or you name it, whatever. They're all basically the same rule. They have plan docs. I could roll it to a QRP anytime those plan docs allow.
Right.
And so, for example, if you've ever set up a 401k through Anderson, you know that our 401ks, profit sharing, Roth 401ks, they all allow in-service distributions, which means you can roll the money out anytime you feel like. Some people's plans don't. So actually, you have to look at the plan, but there's no law that says you can't.
One thing I would add to this, anytime you're going to do this, transfer from a retirement plan to your own QRP, if you can do what's called a trustee-to-trustee direct transfer, is always the best route to go. It causes less issues with the IRS thinking that you took the money out and kept it.
Mm-hmm. Let's see, what is different about filing taxes for option traders as opposed to stock traders? Well, usually stock traders have money on their return. Wait, hold on for a second. Who said that? I'm just kidding. Come on, you guys, lighten up a little bit.
There's any more. There's not a whole lot of difference. As recently as 6 or 7 years ago, we used to get no reporting for option traders.
Now you get the purchase, you get all this.
Yeah, it's so similar to the stock trading. As far as the tax laws themselves, there's absolutely no difference. Short selling, it works a little differently, both for stocks and for options, but otherwise, not much difference.
See, nobody laughed at that either.
It was funny.
See, no, option traders, so when the IRS, somebody did, all right. So if you are trading in the market, the question is, when do you become a business? And I never want to make this a question that I'm trying to prove to the IRS, so I tend to avoid it by using LLCs and corporations. If you are in the stock market and that's what you're doing, then what happens is the losses become ordinary losses if you are a trader in securities. And securities includes both options and stocks and securities. So, and frankly, it could be futures, it could be currencies, it could even be Bitcoin, because Bitcoin is not a currency, it's even a capital asset. So all those things comes into play when you're deciding how to be treated. There is no difference between the tax filing for option traders and stock traders. It all goes on your Schedule D, so your 1040 Schedule D. But if you are going to file as a trader, you better make sure that you're either buying stocks repeatedly throughout the day, and I would say probably 700 trades a year, round trips. Option traders have a much easier time doing that since they tend to be in and out on the option. They swing. They're so volatile. Somebody asked, can a husband and wife filing jointly take two separate Roth IRAs and contribute $7,000 to each IRA each year? Does that make sense?
Actually, you have to have separate IRAs.
Yeah.
They're individual retirement accounts, meaning truly individual. You can't share an IRA.
Yep. Somebody says, how does real estate professional benefit me? I'm just going to touch on this real quick. Real estate professional allows you to deduct all real estate losses against your personal taxes. It becomes ordinary. Here's a fun one. Can an individual place Bitcoin in a Roth IRA account? The answer is yes. It's just whether the plan documents will allow it. It gets back to this thing where if you open up an account, let's say at TD Ameritrade, they might not let you buy real estate or do Bitcoin. They're all capital assets.
The biggest issue here is custodians hate these kind of things. They hate real estate, hard to value assets.
Yep. So you're going to have to go to a...
This is a perfect time for a checkbook IRA.
Either a checkbook IRA or a self-directed IRA, or avoid the IRA and just do a 401k. And in any case, what you want to be away from is someone whose plan documents are saying you can't do it. So if you wanted to do a good self-directed IRA, they'll probably let you do whatever you want in there. If you want to avoid the custodian, you could just do a 401k. Somebody says Pensco, IRA Club. There's a bunch of good ones out there. With us, we do our own 401k, and it lets you do whatever you want. And of course, there are some reasons you use a 401k. You can pool your account together if you're husband and wife, and you can contribute a lot more. So each person could contribute, but it's $19,500 this year, you know, a max of $56,000 with the catch-up provision of an extra $6,000. If you're over, was it 59 and a half. All right. Do you mean 401A, Sarah? You can do so our 401K includes the profit share component to it. So it's basically a solo 401K, which includes the 401A provision and the Roth 401K. So yeah, you can buy it again, whatever you want inside those.
Oh, there are some exceptions though. You can't put collectibles in them.
Yeah. You're talking about. There are certain things you can't buy. Collectibles would be one.
Insurance is the other that I'm aware of.
401ks can actually own insurance. Okay. It has to depend on, it depends on the type of insurance. They generally can't do term. And they depends on the type of gold or precious metal you're buying.
So you can't put rare coins in an IRA, but you can put in modern gold coins.
And somebody's pointing out that the catch-up is actually over 50. Yeah, you're right. It's gray hair. It's 50. So, your catch-up. How lucrative is buying discounted promissory notes and or trust deeds to generate? Oh, somebody's asking a generic question. I thought you meant for like a, how lucrative is buying discounted promissory notes and or trust deeds to generate passive income? If you're asking that inside of an IRA or 401k, that's one thing. If you're just asking in general, it can be very lucrative depending on what you're buying. It always comes down to it.
Now, one thing I had thought about is I approach that magic age of 70 and a half. I am a little more wary of putting hard to value assets in my IRAs or
because you're having to do the required minimum distributions, and then they're going to say, hey, yeah. So, oops, did I not answer this one? Oh, here we go. We got to get on task.
All right, I'll stop talking.
I will be shutting down an LLC which has lots of expenses tied to it. Can these be rolled over to the C Corp or a new LLC? That's an interesting way of saying it. If you shut down an LLC, let's go through this real quick. You're never going to get 1244 stock loss treatment on an LLC. So if you have losses stuck in it, it's going to be a capital loss, which means it's going to offset capital gains. So if you have other capital gains, go for it. Otherwise, you cannot roll them into something else. You need to keep that entity alive and have it generate income at some point.
The only thing I thought was that the LLC was actually disregarded to a C corporation. In that case, I would think those any expenses of the LLC would stay with a C corporation.
Yeah. So if you have an LLC that is disregarded to a C corp, not really seeing that, but yeah, okay. Let's just say that you did, then it would be the C corp. It goes to the owner. But if this is an LLC that's disregarded just in general, those losses you would have taken personally on your Schedule C. If it's partnership, you're going to have some of those losses. If it's a C Corp, you're not. You're just going to have capital losses. If it's an S Corp, can you disregard to an S Corp? Yep, you can actually do that too. Then it all comes down to a whole bunch of what ifs on this.
Yeah, you're just not going to be able to move those expenses to another entity.
Nope, not unless it's owned by one. But yep. Interesting question. So I guess what the answer is really going to be, and it depends. We'd have to look and see, because as you guys know, if you've been on this call before, LLCs do not, that is not a tax designation. So you never say to the IRS, hey, I'm taxed as an LLC. What you do is you take that LLC and you pick a tax treatment of either ignore it, which is called disregarded, treat it as a partnership, treat it as a corporation, and then if it's a corporation, treat it as an S or a C. You're always picking one. And then if it's ignored, then whatever the owner is whatever is where it's going to flow. So a C Corp owns an LLC and makes it disregarded. It's flowing onto that C Corp return.
So somebody asks, can you disregard an LLC to an S corporation? The answer to that is yes, you can.
Absolutely. So good questions. I always love these. So anyway, if you ever want to just annoy somebody, you just say, an LLC is in a tax designation. Show me where it is on the SS4. All right, can I pay my life insurance or a family dental insurance from an LLC? Can the LLC fund my HSA? So we're going to go back to this previous question, and we're going to say, this is why we love these questions. The LLC is not a tax treatment, so we have to determine what it is. So let's say that I have a C-Corp. Then could it pay for your life insurance? It could always pay for your life insurance. The question is whether it's taxable to you, if it does. So most people are aware that there's an exception for group life insurance with a death benefit of under $50,000. I tend to, again, there's some restrictions on if it's top heavy. In a C-Corp, maybe. In an S-Corp, no way. That's always going to be taxable to you. Dental benefits, again, if it's a C-Corp, you can write them off. If it's an S-Corp, it's taxable to you.
Right.
So, and if it's an LLC that's ignored, then it's going to be taxable to you as well. Can the LLC fund my HSA? And again, it depends. If it's a C-Corp, the answer is really, unless it's providing an employee benefit, there's no reason for it. Because you could write it off. So, like, you don't need to have a deduction out of the C-Corp. You wouldn't have the business paying for it. You would just pay for it because you can write it off. It's up to $7,000 this year for a family that you can put
right,
in an HSA.
$3,500 for an individual.
That just stands for health savings account. And let's see. Somebody says, does Anderson Business Advisors have a retirement planning division? I live in Seattle. Yeah, we have an office in downtown of Tacoma on Broadway, so you can absolutely go and check those guys. What about medical insurance premiums? That's a great one, Mina. So if it's a C-Corp, it can reimburse anything and everything that's medically related. If it's for the cure or mitigation of disease, you can write it off. You don't have to worry. The only issue is if I fund an HSA and then I say it's a health savings account, for those who are guys are asking, there's a number of you guys. What it is it's an account that I can write off, and it's really the best of both worlds. I get to write it off as an individual. It's kind of like an IRA, but it's a health savings account. And as long as I use that money for health expenses, I don't have to pay tax on it. So I can write it off and I can use it for medical expenses. Now, if you have a C-Corp already floating around out there, there's no reason to do an HSA. Because an HSA, when I put money into it, I'm going to be doing mutual funds or whatever they're going to allow me to do it. If I keep it in a C-Corp, then the corporation can continue to grow that money however it wants. And it can just reimburse me. So I tend to do, it's called a health reimbursement arrangement, HRA. So we've been loving those for years. In an S-Corp, and in S-Corp, if you're greater than 2% shareholder, it's treated as taxable income too. Somebody says, I have health insurance through my employer. Can I write off those expenses through my C-Corp? So, Walter, the answer is I can't write off anything that I did not pay tax on. So I have to make sure that I'm being reimbursed for something that came out of my pocket, not the employer's pocket. If the employer pays it, but you pay tax on it, you can reimburse it. If the employer pays it and you do not pay tax on it, then you cannot. So let me give you the real life situation. So let's say that I'm married, and in our company, we cover the primary employee for their health. And if you want to cover your family, you can cover it under our plan, but that comes out of your paycheck, the difference. So let's say that it's $500 to cover primary employee, but it's $1,300 to cover the family. Let's do the math. The $500 was covered by the employer of the $1,300. So there's $800 a month that is coming out of my paycheck. Even though it says the employer is paying it, I am reimbursing my employer. Now, my C-Corp could go and reimburse me for that. Absolutely. That would be $9,600 just on the insurance premiums alone. Not to mention, it can also reimburse me for my co-pays and deductibles and anything that's not covered by insurance. Somebody says, hey, a very nice thank you. That's awesome. What if the C-Corp is not making money? Can I write off my medical insurance? Yeah, you can still write it off. It just carries forward. I'm still a W-2 as a C-Corp. The standard deduction on my personal 1040 is already around $22,000. It's $24,400. So should I deduct all medical off the C-Corp? Yes, Sarah. That's the whole point, is we don't want to use up that standard deduction. It's too tough. Plus, you have to exceed, 7.5% of your adjusted gross income before you can even start to take it. What if the $800 was pre-tax? Then you would not reimburse yourself. So if it was pre-tax, then there's nothing to reimburse since you didn't pay for it. Somebody else paid for it. I hope that makes sense. So I'm always looking for stuff that came out of my pocket.
Yeah.
So let's say I had a deductible and the deductible was $5,000. Yeah, your C-Corp can reimburse you for that. We have folks. What's the biggest one you've seen this year in terms of reimbursement?
I've seen them between $10,000 and $20,000. I haven't seen huge ones yet this year.
Yeah, $10,000 and $20,000 just on the insurance, just on the reimbursement alone, and that's about
just
right.
The reimbursement, right?
Yeah, that's tax-free money. Can I use the HSA to offset long-term healthcare premium? I'm not sure if the HSA could be. I don't know the answer sitting here on that one. HSA.
Yeah, I'm not sure about I want to say yes, but I'm not sure.
I think it's just for medical-related expenses, but maybe. But, John, your C-Corp, again, could reimburse you for qualified long-term care premiums for insurance. So that's I thought health care premium and long-term care premium were not taxable. Yes, they are, actually. The IRS says you can deduct them, but then they give you these ridiculous limitations on what you can actually write off. In fact, it's like $400 or something a year.
It's age-related, and if you're pretty young, you're very limited.
And you have to exceed 7.5% of your – yeah. How long will deductions carry over if C-Corp is not making as much? I think it's almost indefinite now.
Yeah, it's
forever. And then, Sarah, what you do is if you have a C-Corp and you eventually just say, I'm done with it, I have all these losses, that's when you dissolve it and you take the losses personally. And that's called a 1244 stock loss. So,
but you got to have stock. It's got to be a corporation.
It's got to be a corporation. This works for your C-Corp members too then. It depends on what you mean by members. So if it's a C-Corp and you have employees, then yeah. In fact, you can't discriminate. So anyway, we got to get to another question. Add Toby. All right. I just learned a property I bought and rehabbed is in an opportunity zone. Opportunity zone. Let me speak it clearly. Can I retroactively qualify for the tax advantages? The answer is no. This is a straightforward. I wish I could say it depends. The only time, actually, I don't think you can.
Because I was thinking the abandoned property. The fund has to be set up before the purchase.
Yeah, so there's three levels of benefit for doing an opportunity zone. And for those of you who don't know what an opportunity zone is, it's an economically disadvantaged area where Congress is giving you tax incentives to invest. The benefit is you can take any capital gain and roll it into that opportunity zone through an opportunity zone fund. An opportunity zone fund is an LLC taxed as a partnership or corporation or a partnership or a corporation. So usually you set up an LLC, tax it as a partnership, and you file a piece of paper with its first return saying it's an opportunity zone. Now, first thing you get is I roll the capital gains that I had to have incurred them in, I think it's 180 days, and there's some ways around that too, depending on whether you had this was through a private placement or something that you were just a passive investor in, or if it's 1231 capital gains, like there's, just think of this. There's like a 180-day test, unless there's an exception.
But the 180 days starts at the
sale.
I was thinking it started as the last day of the year.
It depends. If it's 1231 and it's net loss or net gain, it'll be net gain in this case.
Okay.
It would be from January 1st, or you could choose to use the date of the sale. It depends on what suits your purpose. So there are exceptions. I'm just saying it's 180 days unless you got an exception. So if I just sell, a piece of property and it's in my name, then I'm just going to roll it in there if it's investment property. So let's say I put that in there. I'm deferring that. I'm going to defer that for 7 years right now. You're going to have to pay tax 2026. So you're going to get a nice deferment, but you're only going to pay, and I'm not going to get into all the specifics, but you're going to pay tax on 85% of the gain in 7 years. And then you'll never pay tax on anything again so long as you hold that property for at least 10 years. Even if it makes $10 million, you pay zero tax. That's why people like the opportunity zone. But you can't retroactively get into it. You have to designate and create a fund, and then that fund needs to buy opportunity zone property. And my partner Clint did a fantastic webinar. I'm sure it's up on our site. He goes into this stuff. There's lots of nuances. Let's see. If I understand correctly, I can have my C-Corp reimburse me my life insurance premiums. Nada. Can I reimburse for my wife, which is an officer, and two kids, which is part of the board life insurance premium? So, Robert, it doesn't quite work that way. In theory, you can deduct up to, for a group life policy, that is up to $50,000 of death benefit, which is very minimal amount. And then if it's top heavy, meaning that it's you and your family, then it doesn't work at all. So it's not life insurance, it's health insurance. And yeah, then it could cover all your health expenses. You can do long-term care, though. Let's see. It says, I have an LLC for buy and hold. Some expenses I couldn't deduct because it's not a qualified expense. Can I include these expenses with the C-Corp? Potentially. It depends on what you mean by non-qualified expense. That doesn't make a lot of sense. If it's either something that you can write off or it's not. If it's business related or related to your real estate. If it's not deductible, but it's added to basis, that's a different animal. But if you have expenses that maybe somebody's saying, hey, I can't write them off for whatever reason. You could pay the corporation a fee, write that off individually, and then maybe the corporation can't write it off. You just have to make sure it's not inuring to you personally. to make it taxable to you. So yeah, I hope that helps clarify that. All right. Is there still a mileage deduction if I drive my personal vehicle for my business? Yeah, let's answer that part. Yes. First off, your personal vehicle for your business. Yes. I think it's 58 cents a mile right now.
Right.
Or to get to a job out of state. No. If you're doing the job out of state, unless they're reimbursing you, in which case that business is reimbursing you as its employee. And let's just say they didn't reimburse you, then that's commuting and you would not get to write that off, or it's a personal expense.
And to go back to one thing, when we say, if I drive my personal vehicle for my business, mm-hmm. that's an assumption that it is your business, not that you're working for somebody else.
If you're working for somebody else or it's your business, that business can reimburse you 58 cents a mile. That is not taxable income too.
Right.
Now, you said the mileage deduction. It could also just deduct the actual expense.
Are you looking to lower your taxes, protect your assets, and grow your wealth? Are you a real estate investor, stock trader, or business owner? If you answered yes, Anderson Advisors Tax and Asset Protection Workshop is for you. Let hosts Clint Coons, Toby Mathis, and Michael Bowman teach you how to protect and keep more of what you earn. Our workshops are held monthly throughout the country and via live stream. Two in-person tickets to the workshop are only $99. To learn more about the dates and locations, visit AndersonAP.com and register today.
Let's see. Can RMD payments be sent to a C Corp? Required minimum distributions out of an IRA? Answer is no. You could put it in a C Corp, but it's not going to help you at all.
Yeah, it's still your income.
Yeah.
All right. Can't assign it.
Bad Toby. And we had some questions early on we got to get to also. I have two sub S Corps. So when somebody says sub S Corps, maybe they just mean S Corps.
I think they're saying subchapter S Corps.
All right. Sub S Corps that I have placed all my real estate under. Should I place properties in LLCs? Any tax concerns? So the first thing is, depending on how many pieces of real estate, I would always separate them out into, oh, by the way, somebody says, is the mileage and unreimbursed employee expense no longer deductible? Correct. They did away with miscellaneous itemized deductions under the Tax Cut and Jobs Act. You can no longer write them off on your Schedule A. Unreimbursed employee expenses are no longer deductible. It sucks, but that's just, yeah.
And some people have substantial expenses.
Right. And that's horrible.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you have to write Congress and thank them. Though you'd have to stand in line behind all the guys with the salt limitation. You have clients that are losing out on $40,000 and $50,000 of deductions in New York and California and Maryland and New Jersey and Connecticut, and they're all ticked off. All right, so I have two S-Corps, and I have lots of real estate. So you should separate the real estate. Remember what we said about inside liability and outside liability. It still applies even for S-Corps. You want to make sure that you don't have 10 pieces of property where there's a fire on one and it costs you the other nine. Now, the reason you don't typically put real estate in an S-Corp is because if you take it out, it's a taxable event and it's treated as wages. So if you ever distribute that property to yourself, you're going to have an issue if it's appreciated. If it hasn't appreciated, then no harm, no foul. You could, I guess, potentially buy it out of it if you wanted to do that. But again, it's better to just use disregarded entities or partnerships and not get yourself into that pickle. If you're just going to hold them forever, then when basis, you have a step up in basis when you pass, then your estate can fix the problem.
And partnerships don't have that issue.
Yeah, partnerships never have that issue. Is there a limit for depreciation deduction and cost segregation on an investment property? No, like the depreciation, you're writing it off. Yeah, I'm just going to say no. Somebody just asked a question. Somebody says, here's one that's relevant to this question. So what's the difference between having a real estate investment company as an S-Corp and the company also owns the property, which falls under the S-Corp? Would the rule still apply about not having property in an S-Corp? I'm not sure I quite understand that, but let me try to figure this one out. So a real estate investment company, if what you're talking about is something that's flipping, we're buying and selling and we're just keeping it off our personal return as a dealer. If we're holding and we're buying these things to accumulate, then that S Corp holding it, if I take the property out and I distribute it to a shareholder, that's treated as ordinary income. Whereas if the same scenario, let's say I had an LLC taxed as a partnership, I could distribute the property out to that shareholder. They could refi it, put it back in. No tax, no foul. I do that with an S Corp. I have a taxable event. There may be an exception. Somebody mentioned an exception once, another attorney. I haven't seen it. I couldn't find it, but they said, oh, if you take it out to refi, you can put it back in. I'm not aware of that exception. It doesn't mean it may be not out there, but I certainly couldn't find it.
Sounds logical, so it's probably not true.
Yeah. Anyway, it gets kind of clunky. Next one. how do we navigate the standard deduction in the business sector? So actually someone just said, so essentially the owner of the real estate here, I'm going to go back to this one just because I'm getting clarification. So essentially the owner of a real estate business with real estate titled under the S corporation is costing themselves. Yes. Yeah. You don't need to do that. You shouldn't do that. Doesn't mean people won't. Like, I will sell my house to capture a deduction to an S corp if I'm going to keep that house and I still want my $500,000 121 exclusion. I might sell it to an S corp, but I'm never selling it and I'm probably never going to refi it. I'm just going to keep it in there and rent it forever. And then when I die, I let my family deal with it. You know, they'll get a step up in basis and they can distribute the money out because now you have basis equal to the value of the property, no taxable event. That's always the issue. If you have appreciated assets inside of an S corp and you distribute them, that appreciation. So I bought a house for $100,000, it's worth $200,000. I distribute it to a shareholder. My basis is $100,000. The value of the property is $200,000. That means I have $100,000 of taxable income just by transferring that. So I don't have that in a partnership. I don't have that in a disregarded entity. I only have that in an S corp. So let's go back to this question. How do we navigate the standard deduction in the business sector? You could answer this one. You love this stuff.
I'm not sure what they're asking.
I knew that was going to happen.
There is no standard deduction on any business return.
Yep. So if the question is this, actually, okay. I can see what it comes into. So you have your standard deduction, and it's really high. So let's say I'm just going to use for an example. I have married filing jointly. I have a $24,400. I think that's what it is. Standard. Is that it for 2019?
Yeah.
Standard deduction. So in that standard deduction, I have things like my mortgage interest. I have charity. I have health. I have my state and local taxes. So I add all those things up and they're part of that $24,000. If you have a business and you're underneath that $24,400, then what you have to ask yourself is, hey, maybe if I was to give money charitably, I wouldn't get to write it off because I'm underneath the $24,400. But if I have a business out here, rather than give the money to charity, maybe I do an expense for advertising to the 501c3. So I might give it money in exchange for something. So I go to my church. And instead of just giving them money that I would never get to write off, I say, hey, I have a business. How about you list my business in your programs and I give you $5,000? You'd give them $5,000 anyway, but now you're doing it in exchange for something. Now it becomes a business expense, which I can write off 100%. And now I don't have to worry about my standard deduction. I get to take my full standard deduction. And that $5,000 would have done me zero good if I had done it as an individual. Now, people are starting to see this. The charities last year, on a inflation-adjusted basis, charitable giving by individuals was down, I want to say, 3.6%. It was not a small amount of money. It was billions of dollars that it was down because they're not getting as many deductions for it. Now, what's interesting is charitable giving as a whole was up because more and more people are giving to their foundations, which are giving the charitable deductions, and businesses were giving more. Mm-hmm. So it made up the gaps. Like, I used to call it Taxmageddon. The unintended consequence of the Tax Cut and Jobs Act was that charities were going to lose out on billions of dollars of giving because nobody was going to do it if they don't get a tax benefit. And of course, enough people were seeing the ways around it, which we say, hey, do multiple years. Use your own charity, use a DAFI, a donor advised fund, if you don't know what that is. Do all these things where we're able to give more tax deducted in a particular year.
Right.
And it seemed to make up a lot more than what they anticipated. It was great. So you guys, Americans give away lots of money. And if they have a tax benefit, they'll even give away more. So that's how you use a business to navigate that standard deduction. Try to think of any others. The other way, by the way, is here's another one just for funds, for giggles. So there's a little mortgage interest. If you have a home office, and I'm not talking about a Schedule C, I'm talking about an administrative office in your home. So administrative office, and your employer, which can be you, reimburses you, you can knock off a percentage of even your mortgage interest and your property taxes. So I can hit these guys right here through my business. My health, if you have a C corp, we can reimburse that too. And what we're allowing ourselves to do is reimburse ourselves expenses, write them off through the company, and then I can just take my standard deduction.
And this is really a good tool when you're being hit by that SALT limitation, the limitation on state local income taxes.
Absolutely.
Is you're limited to $10,000 of that deduction, but if you can put some of it on at a home office or other places, they're perfectly deductible there.
Yep. Now, let's talk. How do you keep learning? I know that you guys are all on the call, and I love that you guys are all on the call. There's only so much we're going to be able to get to here. This little guy right here, $197, is the TaxWise workshop. I went over 31 tax strategies over 2 days at the last workshop, which was awesome, if I may say so myself. It was just me, my sorry butt, talking for 2 days, and we packed, like we went through so much stuff. So we have that recording. We have the recording from January, and you can live attend via live cast, I should say, at least a live stream, meaning that you can, how do I say it? You're not physically at the location, but you're watching it live. So a live cast sounds neat. Live stream. Yeah, there we go. Live stream. You get all of that for a one price of $197. You just go to Enersit Advisors 341 right down here. And do that. Here's the rub. You do that, the typical savings are somewhere in the $10,000 mark from what we've been able to gather from surveying our clients. And the best part is we're looking for 3 deductions. I'm saying that we're going to go over 31, pick 3, implement them. You never know what you're going to say. Now somebody says, so you're saying I need a separate organization besides the C-Corp to get donation write-off? No, you could just use your C-Corp. Your C-Corp can actually use the 501c3 and advertise with it. That's one of the best things you can do, by the way, is have your business sponsoring charities that you care about. Now, you can own the charity, you know.
Now, I'm going to say that a C-Corp is probably the worst place in the world to make charitable donations.
You don't make it as a donation. You make sure that you're doing this little guy.
Yep.
You're doing advertising. So you need something in return. If they say, just give me money, say no. That's what you do as an individual. If I want to give money with strings attached, like, hey, I get to give everybody a T-shirt.
Right.
I'm going to do advertising. You're going to put my name out there. You're going to give me recommendations from the pulpit. Hey, this Sarah is awesome. Her company is awesome. They do this and you rock, you know, so it's fun. If somebody says, hey, at the next live stream, could you hit more on traders in the stock market? Of course. And Robert, I also have a very good live stream that I did that was half a day that was only on traders in the stock market that I can send you to. So shoot over a request at Tax Tuesday at AndersonAdvisors.com. Patty or somebody can get you that. I did that a while ago. I did that last year. It hasn't changed. It was right. It was after the Tax Cut and Jobs Act came out, and it was pretty hot and heavy on this stuff because if you're a stock trader, you lost the ability to do Schedule A deductions. So anybody that does that, you gotta be using an actual entity structure to get your deductions. So I won't jump into too far, but Robert, I could absolutely help you with that. It'll be my pleasure. Also, freebies, iTunes, go to Anderson Business Advisor Podcast. And Robert, you got the right setup there, brother. So that's perfect. So you do iTunes and or Google Play. In either case, you go to Anderson Advisors Podcast. There we go. And you got replays in the Platinum Portal. You can go in there. I'm going to answer a bunch more questions, guys. We had a bunch from the very beginning that I'm going to get to. And you can always go follow us on social media. Make sure that if you like this sort of stuff, we do a ton on YouTube. And click the little icon that says, I don't know what it says.
Subscribe, I believe, YouTube.
It's not just subscribe, but there's a little icon that will like notify you when new videos come out.
Oh, yes, yes.
Only when you log in. So it's not like it hits you in your emails, but it'll let you know what's new because we're always putting stuff out. I know that I record constantly and I do a lot of podcasts with people. I just did one on buy-sell agreements, key man insurance. I did one earlier this week. What was that on? Let me think. The recesses of my brain. I don't know. I've done some pretty cool ones. That Frank Cottle was one of my favorites. I did one with the Camp You Can and a gal that did a TED Talk. All that stuff is really cool. You can always submit your questions at Tax Tuesday. More complicated. We're just going to farm you out to one of the lawyers or one of the accountants and make them answer it. And you can always visit Anderson Advisors. Again, we love to give stuff away. That's just in our DNA. All right. So let's go back to some of this. This is what I love. What is the best way to set up my accounting and tax business? So, Rory, great question. And the best way I can answer that is it depends how much revenue you're going to make. Most people, if they're living off of it, it's going to be an S corp.
Yeah, I like the PLLC if your state has that, yeah. And then filing as an S corporation.
Yep, you always have to be careful. Somebody asked, and they've left, but hopefully they hear this. When one of the members of an LLC passes away, what happens to his or her share in the LLC? So first off, Jeff's going to make fun of you for saying share. It's a membership interest. LLCs don't have shares, right, Jeff?
It doesn't have shares.
Yeah, all right.
Which is why you can't take 1244, but we're not going to talk about that right now.
Right. Geek, tax geek. All right. So when one of the members of an LLC passes, it depends on your operating agreement. So if you have an operating agreement, it's like in our case, I know what ours say, which is the survivors, the heirs, become an assignee interest holder. They don't get to become members unless the other members choose to allow their shares to have voting rights and have full membership. Otherwise, they just sit out there and they have a profit interest. The reason you do that is because maybe Jeff and I are partners, but maybe I don't want to be partners with his wife or his kids or whoever he leaves it to. Right. So if something happens to Jeff, I want to make sure that I have protection. I always say do this stuff also in a buy-sell agreement. And also, if you have partners and they're really important, make sure you have key man insurance on them so that if they pass, that you have, your company has some money to hire a replacement. This is really important stuff sometimes. So there's that. Anything you want to jump on?
No, I was just thinking if it's a professional organization, there may be regulations that determine how many non-professionals can be involved.
Yep. And I'll say this, make sure you own it through a living trust. You don't want to have to get into a probate with these things.
No.
It gets ugly and it gets expensive. All right. If a real estate property is gifted to a child, can the child sell the gifted property at any time, or are there certain consequences if the child sells the problem? So if you're the recipient of a gift, technically you're getting the basis in the property, right?
You're getting the donor's basis.
You're getting the donor's basis. So if they sell it right after, the tax consequences would be as though you sold it.
Here's my concern, though.
Mm-hmm.
If you give gift real estate to a minor, can that minor...
I don't even think that they can own it.
I don't think they can own it because they can't sell it. They
right.
cannot go initiate a real estate contract.
Right. So they, generally speaking, if you're doing it, it's through something either an UGMA or, which is Uniform Gift to Minors Act Trust, or it's something else where somebody else is acting on behalf of it.
Some kind of FBO.
Yeah. So because the child doesn't have the capacity to sell, they cannot be a signatory on it. So it's usually going to be somebody acting in their stead, either a parent or... Again, I think that they automatically create an UGMA.
I think contract law is going to be the biggest blockade.
Yeah, but then the other issue you have is for the parent. If it's kiddie tax, which is passive income, then it's added to the parent's tax return. So the child doesn't have a lower tax bracket unless it's active income. So you could have a little bit of a problem. And then it says same tax year, 2 years within the exchange. I'm not certain. It's ringing a bell as though. I'm trying to think of if you sell a piece of property that's been gifted to you, whether there's something that's lurking out there. Can't remember.
There is a passive losses play into that they stay with who sold or who donated the property rather than who was receiving.
Okay. So I got to, maybe we look at that one a little bit, but I don't think there's certain consequences if you sell if there's gain.
One thing I think you could do in this case, though, is to gift them a very minor portion of the property. Maybe every year, that can probably get tedious, but then they have a minority interest, and I would think the majority could still sign for any sales.
Yeah, it's possible. But again, I think they're going to be a passive holder, which is just going to go right under the parents.
Yeah.
Yeah, so this is something you better be holding it for a while. I probably wouldn't give it to them if they were just going to sell it. It's not going to really help them. Is there an easy answer to how to set up a brokerage account and business entity for trading stocks, not looking for trader tax status, but definitely above average trading? Been told an LLC is the way to go. So Brandon, I would have it in an LLC. And here's just word to the wise right now. Brokerage houses, if you open up an account in an LLC, about 50% of them are going to try to hit you with extra costs saying you're a professional trader. So what you do is, generally speaking, depending on where you're setting it up, we would just do a personal property trust, and then we'd assign the beneficial interest to an LLC, and that LLC is managed by a corporation. Sounds more complicated than it is. What ends up happening is the LLC is being essentially taxed to you. I would set it up as a partnership, and the corporation would be a general partner under it, and they would get guaranteed payments, and that allows me to write off all my expenses. And so I would only pay tax on the net taxable income after those expenses. The reason that we do that is because Schedule A expenses are gone under the Tax Cut and Jobs Act. You never get to write them off. And I'm with you. Don't try to qualify as trader tax status. Every time I see it, it's a guaranteed audit almost. Like it's a huge high percentage of people that get critiqued because it doesn't exist in the tax code. It's this weird thing that somebody does that says, hey, we're going to take our expenses on Schedule C with zero income, and we're going to report all the income on Schedule D. It's such a weird situation. It kicks it out, and you get audited. So why would you invite an audit? It's just not worth it. Let's see. As I understand, the child would receive tax basis of the donor. Yep, as well as the holding period. Also, does the recipient also receive that use of the property for determining qualification for Section 121. No, they would, Ross, they actually have to live there. You can't get somebody else. Let's see. My husband has an IRA pre-tax and a Roth. He's 69 now and doesn't foresee needing the money from these accounts. How can we somehow transfer these accounts now in the future to the wife's retirement account in a manner that best reduces taxes? So, Kim, unfortunately, there's not a way to transfer it to the wife's account. They would just take the money. Even if they don't need it, they're going to have a little tax on it. What you may want to do, if you want to make it like pretty simple, it depends on the tax situation. You may want to look at converting it to a Roth. And then as the money comes out, you either take it or you don't. I don't think that Roth is required to be distributed.
No.
And it just keeps growing tax free. So you might want to just say, hey, I'll take the tax hit now. I don't need to take distributions out of it. So I'll convert it to a Roth. And then when you inherit the Roth, there's not a tax hit on it. So if the surviving spouse, for example, they would get all that money tax free. How would you divide building and land depreciation for condos? So both residential condo and for an office condo. So that's interesting. So you, for depreciation, it's just the building. You'd never depreciate land. And then if it's an office condo.
But what we've seen is IRS wants some part of your cost to go to land.
Yeah.
Even though technically you don't own any of the land.
You do an assessed value, the percentage of the assessed value. So you'd have to look at what the assessed land value is. You'd use those percentages.
Yeah, typically for a condo, whether it's an office condo or a residential condo, that land percentage is going to be much lower than it would be for a single family home or even a multi-family home.
And so, and that would be good.
Right. All right. Your depreciation would be higher.
Yep. So you can use any reasonable method. I think most of the time you're going to use whatever the tax
assessment. A lot of times we use the tax assessment if for nothing else to get us a ratio.
And I don't foresee you getting nailed on that no matter what. They're just, they're not able to figure it out if you're not able to figure it out. They're just going to say, is it reasonable? David, I have a vacation rental LLC formed by Anderson. I follow Form 1065. Is it better to take a Section 179 deduction on my furniture versus 5-year depreciate? Well, you get immediate deduction. IRS says you cannot unless it's used in your trade or business. If renting the vacation home is my business, can I take furniture and computer used to rent properties as depreciation under 179 versus 5 years? Thank you.
So furniture and equipment used in the rental is not eligible for 179.
Yeah, so it would just be bonus depreciation.
Bonus depreciation.
Yeah, so you're not going to have to 179 it, but you're still going to get to write it off. And you're not going to have to do it over 5 years. You can elect to treat it as an immediate deduction.
So it might be 5-year or even 7-year property, but you're still going to deduct it all in the first year.
Yep, so you can write it off, David. So, you know. As a federal employee, can I open a Roth IRA in my TSP? Well, I understand I can contribute $7,000 each year into the IRA over and above the maximum contribution and catch-up contribution. Is that correct?
I did have a TSP when I was with IRS. I don't know if at that time they had a Roth provision. I want to say that's probably something you need to discuss with your TSP sponsor.
I don't think there's a special rule on it. So I think that what you're really getting into is you can either do a traditional IRA or you can do the Roth,
or you can
do the Roth inside the TSP, depending if it's part of the plan document. In which case,
The TSP is a thrift savings plan, which is a federal retirement.
Right, but it would have to be in the plan.
It would have to be in the plan itself.
And usually you can go up to $19,600 or what is that now, $25,500?
With a catch-up, yes.
Yeah, with a catch-up. So you could put a lot into a Roth. I can show you ways.
I'm pretty sure the TSP has a Roth provision, though.
If it does, then, again, you would want to talk to them. And, it's more than $7,000 higher. You're going to be able to put a bunch of money in. I'm going to answer one more. Please explain a spendthrift trust advantages, disadvantages. Does it replace a revocable living trust? So, Philip, spendthrift trust is a special statute, depending on the state you look at. The number one state, according to Forbes, is Nevada. I happen to agree with it. Because we have what's called a credit shelter trust, which is the same thing. Somebody cannot force distributions out of it to a beneficiary. And if you have permissible beneficiaries and a crafty lawyer, they know how to make it to where nobody can force money out of it. It doesn't replace a revocable living trust because the revocable living trust has a lot of other provisions in it. The medical power of attorney, the living will, the end of life decisions. Your personal assets and a spendthrift trust, it can never make you ill. What is it called? It can't make you bankrupt. You can't put more assets than you have outside of it in it. because it makes you insolvent and you cannot, you know, you should, so you never do that. So you use them in conjunction, but they're a very effective tool. I know them very well. All right. So one other thing, if putting a multi-member LLC, how do you still show active and material participation to allow a 1031 exchange? You don't. So here's the beautiful part. You don't have to show material participation to do a 1031 exchange. You just have to show an investment and you're buying like-kind property, which is real estate. With that, we are going to bid you adieu. We've gone a little over, this time only half an hour over, Chad.
Yeah, it's not bad.
All right. So until next time, guys, thank you for joining us. I'm just going to look at the very end and see if there's anything else. Thank you. There's a few other questions. We will grab it. So this guy says the TSP has a Roth. So we know that. So that helps to have. We will get the other questions if they're still lagering out there, and we will make sure that we get those answered. If nothing else, I will see you guys in 2 weeks. On behalf of Jeff and I want to say thanks for joining us. Thanks, guys.
We'll see you next time.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. Show notes for links to everything mentioned in this episode can be found on our website at andersonadvisors.com/podcast. Be sure you subscribe to our podcast, and if you are already a subscriber, please provide us a review of what you thought of this episode.